This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Dr. Jonathan Abel. I'm here with Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And we have a special guest today, Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Kyle Hatzinger from the Department of Sustainment and Force Management here at CGSC. Colonel Hatzinger, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And as you might notice, Colonel Hatzinger has two titles. One of those is as a historian. So we're going to talk to him today about a little known but very important part of the U.S. Army, and that's what we now refer to as mortuary affairs. So give us kind of a very general overview. When we say mortuary affairs, what are we talking about?
Sure. Well, mortuary affairs encompasses from, we got to use very in-your-face terms, but when the soldier is killed all the way through when they are buried. And what we see now in the Army is that is, point of death, and in as little as a week, that soldier could be brought home and interred, whereas as we think of what we'll talk about, graves registration, different terminology, but same idea, point of death, but maybe 4, 5, 6 years until they were finally interred, sometimes in the near or at the location they were killed, or in the United States. So it's the idea of what we think about it and what we expect is morphed, but the idea is the same. We have a soldier that's killed, and we provide them honors for their final interment.
So this is something that kind of evolves over time. I know in my period, in the early modern period, battlefields after battles are not great places. And if people are familiar with Les Miserables, the book, there's a whole long sequence where one of the characters goes to Waterloo after the battle, and there are lots of dead bodies. In fact, that's where they got teeth for dentures from dead soldiers. But there wasn't really a concerted effort to bury them so much. Eventually, the locals might get around to it, if only to prevent disease. So in the earliest years of the American Army, and maybe through the 19th century, how does this work? What happens after a battle?
So very much like you describe, is you have dead, and burials are mostly done because of sanitary conditions. And it's not only the dead humans, but the dead horses.
Right.
I think one of my favorite macabre descriptions after Gettysburg is just all the flies.
Yep.
And that's really what prompts the locals, hey, we got to get this done.
Right.
Now, are we talking individual burials? Are we talking mass burials?
Yes. And so there's a little bit of caste in this as well, especially Seminole Wars, Mexican Wars. Individual officers, you see accounts of caissons drawing caskets and bands and everything, but then the first U.S. cemetery overseas is in Mexico City, and it's 750 unknown burials just kind of put together.
Right.
And in the Civil War, we finally start seeing a little bit more towards the individual burials. We're trying to capture names of not just officers, but enlisted men. And it's interesting that that kind of sequences with this idea of a national army. It's not just, the criminals and whomever else that, we can kind of forget about them, but it's a, volunteer army. It's, a drafted army. Well, okay, we've given you our sons. You owe us them back.
Right.
If and when they're killed. But the Civil War is really that first place where you see the government attempting to say, we need to do something about this in an organized fashion. There's War Department general orders that say commanders are responsible for the dead. But the commanders, what you see in practice is, I've got the living that I've got to be concerned with, and the dead are just kind of an afterthought.
Right.
The first big cemeteries, Antietam, Gettysburg, are the locals doing something about it. But General Rosecrans out in the West, Chattanooga, Chickamauga, he actually takes this general order to heart. and creates some of the first army initiative cemeteries.
Now, you mentioned a term at the beginning, and I want to kind of pull back on it because we're going to kind of keep back to this. Can we say final internment?
Yes.
Kind of the place where that person will rest in perpetuity. A lot of the times in these battlefields, you'd see guys buried quickly.
Yeah.
Now, how much effort are they, and who is making the effort to move to identify that this is where this person's going to stay, or are we sending this person back home?
So, very disorganized. I can't, in my research, not really in the Civil War, but what I have found thus far is it really just depends. Families are able to pay undertakers to come in and bring bodies back to homes for burial. But you see this kind of dark underbelly of that undertakers are fleecing families for money and saying, oh yeah, I can get you that. And then they get there and they're like, I can't find them, and just grabbing a body and bringing it back. So it's really, right. It gets to the point where General Grant, when he comes back east, he bans them.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's causing more harm than good. But sometimes you'll have individual soldiers that, this is my friend. I know this is my friend. I want to make sure he's buried before I leave. And so they'll, put him in the ground, try to mark a temporary headstone. But then, like you said, final interment, if it was at Gettysburg or Antietam, as they're collecting bodies for this national cemetery, they'll get disinterred and then reinterred.
And then identifying them as a problem. I mean, the notorious thing at Battle of Cold Harbor, right, where the soldiers writing their names
pencils.
And pinning it on.
And that became another cottage industry as well, is selling in identity discs with your name engraved or a bracelet that you could have on you to, mm-hmm. become identified. Because this is a concern that, you're just going to be part of this mass of bodies that all these soldiers have seen in these previous battles. And war gets more industrial, the nature of the dead just becomes harder and harder to identify.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about some of the drivers of this. I know in Europe there are kind of conflicting ideals. One of them, the older Catholic one, you have to be buried in sacred ground, usually around a church, but that's just simply not true of most people because they're too poor. What are kind of the ideological and religious factors going into this in America, which is largely a Protestant, if not by practice, certainly by governing ideal place in the 19th century?
Sure. There's certainly a driver, and I think you see that in the cemeteries and the design of the cemeteries themselves. A lot of religious undertones in the design. And really, when they're talking about headstones, it's cross.
Right.
And matter of fact, it took a Jewish soldier writing the Jewish Welfare Board to say, hey, we've got the sons of Moses and Abraham being buried under a cross because it's just such a prominent Christian idea. And when the American Battle Monuments Commission says, what should we have? Should we have crosses? Should we just have stones like Arlington? And someone's saying, well, crosses, they'll break. They're very hard to maintain. And someone finally says, I can't imagine it being anything but a cross. And that was the end of the discussion. So you do see a lot of primacy of religion.
Yeah.
And two, the idea of chaplains that are going to preside over these interments, and not only preside over the interments, but write the families and say, I was there.
Yeah.
Even though if you kind of dig into research, the chaplains are giving company commanders a kind of a form questionnaire of, tell me about the soldier, so that they can...
Right. Because, but at least they're making an effort.
They are definitely making an effort. And I think that's where you see the army connecting with society in a very interesting way, is that, dead. And I saw this in my own personal experience. When a soldier dies, everybody wants to just kind of shy away from it. And this family's interaction, this may be the family's only interaction with the army. And they don't care how well you did with the previous five, how well you did with the next five.
Yeah.
They care about your interaction with them, and that will shape their feelings towards the army.
You touched on something else I think that's very important in this period, and we had a previous podcast on how we get to the point of having basically national battlefield monuments, and that's the intersection of death, military death, and place. So creating these military cemeteries. You mentioned there's one in Mexico, but that's I doubt many Americans visit that even at the time, much less now.
Yeah.
But in something like Arlington, that's in the middle of America. At that time, it's more or less the middle of America. So what's driving the idea that we need to have not just a kind of battlefield cemetery or collection point, but that we need to have this space that Lincoln will say in the Gettysburg Address is kind of a hallowed space?
Yeah, it really is born out of, you know, the ideals, I think, of, or what we thought the ideals were coming out of World War I. Spanish-American War is an interesting case study in and of itself, and I didn't realize how important it was until I was on the dissertation track, because here's our overseas, you know, military operations in really two theaters, and it's midway through that that McKinley gets a report from a chaplain in Cuba. He says, "Hey, there's dead scattered everywhere. Like, this is not this is not what we're about, really." He talks about the values and the sanitary conditions, and McKinley says, "Hey, all of our dead are going to be properly marked. After the war, we're bringing them home."
And he was, if I remember correctly, McKinley had himself spent some time in seminary, so I think I think he has somewhat of religious sentiment.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he doesn't bring that out in the general order or anything, but yeah, it'd be interesting to know if that was on his mind. Yeah. But I think what is interesting is $200,000 is appropriated for this action to occur, and it's the first time the United States, for an overseas operation, says this is what's going on with our dead specifically.
And that's a fairly grisly task.
Very much so.
Because it's not just putting a body in the ground where it is. You're now talking about doing something with that body
in the tropics.
In the tropics. Yeah. From Cuba to someplace in the U.S.
Right. And this is Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines that now we are undertaking this. And then by extension, it'll actually encompass China as well for some of our soldiers. So it we really sign ourselves up for a lot, given where we are as a country. But there's four guys that really, between all those islands, they're the ones that make it happen. Two are chaplains, and they go around. You know, Henry McCook, famously on Cuba, he's going around, and he has his book's really neat because he goes to individual grave sites. He's sketching them out. He's describing where they are, and it's really, his report becomes the book, but it's how he's trying to capture where everybody is, knowing that in a couple years we're going to have to bring them back.
Right. So kind of, as it's weird to think of it this way, but it's almost an archaeological expedition.
Yes. Yeah, and that's where, you know, a lot of our success in World War I is born out of this, because it's how do you describe a grave that even if the headstone or something goes missing, or you know, the weather takes it, how do we know where to get it? You know, 6 feet from this clump of fir trees, and you know, I mean, all these little descriptions, because we can't just take a GPS plot,
right? Or ground penetrating radar or something like that.
Yeah. D.H. Rhodes, same one. You go to National Archives One, and there's these giant, almost look like photo albums, and beautiful artwork that he's sketching out where all these things are.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, the beginning of the idea of the Soldier's Cross, which is the bayoneted rifle thrust into the ground, helmet placed on top. It's the idea of initial marking.
It's the idea of something. We need something to preserve it, because, you know, wood used during the Civil War, it doesn't hold. It especially doesn't hold in the tropics. And Charles Pierce, who's the chaplain out in the Philippines doing this, he says, hey, we need something. Our soldiers need something that may just be a trinket of service, but if they die, it will help us preserve their identity. And he writes this report in 1901. 5 years later, we have identification tags. And so it's born out of this idea of preserving identity. And what are the ways that we can do that?
So let's put these two kind of 19th century concepts together. One of them, the domestic war, the Civil War. One of them, the foreign war. Arlington National Cemetery is kind of the locus of what we're talking about. It's a domestic war, and it's I think perhaps unique, at least at the time, being what it is. So how do we get Arlington? Where does Arlington come from, and how does it become that center?
So Arlington begins formally in 1864 with some of the first burials there of Civil War soldiers, but it's on high ground. If you ever go, if you're walking across the Arlington Bridge, you see Arlington House, which was General Lee's home.
Right.
And so necessarily, really early in the Civil War, we seize that because it's high ground. If you had cannon up there, you're now shelling D.C. But the Quartermaster General Montgomery Meigs, there's thoughts that he does this to kind of spite Lee of start burying Union soldiers in his front yard. But that's how it begins. It's just military necessity that we have these dead, and especially around Washington, soldiers dying of disease, training, and what do we do with them? Well, this land really isn't ours, so here we go. But it kind of catches on. And in the Spanish-American War, it becomes the de facto place for bodies that are not claimed by families. If it's unknown or nobody is there to claim it at the port, it's going to Arlington. Mm-hmm. For the Philippines, it'll be the Presidio Cemetery out in San Francisco. But it just kind of grows like that. And by World War I, it is what we're thinking of. And Pershing actually says, I want our overseas cemeteries to be miniature Arlingtons.
And I want to back up on that. We said claimed by a family. So there's an administrative task here of body, soldier, family, notify family, get answer from family, move family or some representative to port, and then moving from there. Do we know how that kind of went?
In the Spanish-American War, not as smoothly. But I can, if you put a pin in that, during World War I, we'll get the whole thing. But you start to see little things of, well, first you have to notify the family that their son is dead, or husband, or father, whomever. And then you wait. How long? I don't know. But then we'll let you know when they're on a ship and coming home and to what port. And, well, then what? How do I get them?
There's no DD-93, which is record of...
there is by contact. World War One.
Okay.
There is by World War One, interestingly enough. Because that's that record that they'll go to, but as we well know, those are not always accurate.
Is there any difference at this point, so again, still 19th century, between killed in battle, killed as a result of some military action, or died of disease, accident, whatever?
In terms of the burials, it doesn't seem that way. They're all held with this reverence that they were serving, they were part of the United States. We will see there is one distinct difference come World War I that starts to emerge. But as far as those categories, no, they all, it's still a dead soldier that needs final disposition, as it were.
What about kind of the more distasteful side of this, which is criminals?
Yes. So I think famously in Civil War, 19th century, you look at the Andersonville Cemetery, you have the prisoners that were, what are they called, the raiders or whatever, that they executed in the prison. They are buried separately. Mm-hmm. I didn't delve too much in Civil War or find any evidence in the Spanish-American War, but definitely World War One, you had 11 that were executed through courts martial for various crimes. They were not separated. Mm-hmm. But in World War II, there is, as a result of that, a definite discussion of, hey, we can't do this again because there's so many more, and we don't want the dishonored dead to be amongst the honored dead.
Here on Fort Leavenworth, there's multiple cemeteries around Leavenworth. So you have the VA Cemetery, which is out in town. You have the National Cemetery, which is on post. There is actually a smaller prisoners' cemetery, which is separated from the National Cemetery, and that is for dead of the military prison were mm-hmm. buried. Same basic
idea. And the German cemetery.
Yes.
So you do, and that's a great point, too, of your enemy dead, again, usually because of sanitary conditions, but put them somewhere else.
Right. Don't bury the Nazis next to the Americans.
Yeah.
So let's push forward into the 20th century, because I think a lot's going to change in a lot of ways. You mentioned we've already had kind of a prototypical dog tag. Let's talk about that for a minute. Is it the standard stamped metal II at that point?
So as U.S. soldiers sailed for France in 1917, they had one. They had a circular, it was aluminum stamped. And it's a very soft aluminum.
Which could be problematic.
And it does become problematic because what they eventually find is, first, that one isn't enough because, okay, if we have one, great, it goes with the body, but then we don't have anything permanent for their temporary grave marker. So they had a second, and actually, fun fact, you know, you find the emergency second dog tags if they're square. So the earliest guys have a round dog tag and a square dog tag, and that was the one that was made once they got into France.
Okay.
And then later guys have two circular ones. But what they find is that this aluminum, if you bury a soldier and their dog tag is against their skin, as decomposition happens, some of the gases and liquids will just erase that etching.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating because in the original burial files, which are at the Personnel Record Center, they still have some of those. And you can just see that you'll see like partial stamps and then just
gone. This with older burials too. So particularly acidic soil, you'll find that something that's against the body tends to erode, like leather,
yep,
more than something that's maybe next to the body.
Definitely. And the GRS, the Graves Registration Service, puts out a thing that says, hey, if you can, just pull those up and have either a shirt or their uniform, just something to kind of prevent this.
You hit on a very important, you said the Graves Registration Service. So that is actually a part of the U.S. Army whose job it is to do this.
Yes.
Is that a new thing in World War One?
That name is. So there's a burial corps in the Spanish-American War, but it's very ad hoc. There's civilians, there's military, but 1917, they pull Charles Pierce, who was our Philippines chaplain, out of retirement and say, we need you to head this, because he had 100% identification rate in the Philippines. Inherited a mess, brought organization to it, and so they pull him out of retirement, said, you know, create this Graves Registration Service. So he's in Philadelphia at his house recruiting the first company for this that'll sail to France. So yeah, so at the Army level, we now have a dedicated organization to ensuring that soldiers are temporarily buried and we know where they're at.
And how do they kind of fit into the Army structure?
So they are, the headquarters is really at the AEF level. There are companies that will go out at the Army level and Corps level, but they are really retained high. And again, it's not, these are not the guys digging ditches. Pershing again reiterates, commanders are responsible for burying the dead. Doesn't always happen that way, but it's still a commander responsibility. Graves registration is to come through, okay, this is where they buried them, we're confirming identifications, we're confirming locations, so that later we can come by, disinter them, consolidate them into temporary cemeteries, and we're retaining this identification through the whole process until whatever final interment looks like. Pierce recommends to Pershing, we can't bring soldiers home like we did during the Spanish-American War right away. Our ships out are going to have supplies and soldiers. We can't be bringing caskets and things like that. The ships back are going to have the wounded. We can't be putting the dead on there. Pershing agrees. And so as families are notified, it says, once the war's over, we will be bringing bodies home.
So take us through this process in World War One. So the AEF, the American Expeditionary Force, the American Army, is in the battle. They're basically plugged into the Entente right. Let's say a soldier dies on the Meuse River.
Okay.
What's the process now?
Sure. So the commander will write in his report, his casualty report, that'll go through the adjutant general sections that the soldier, so-and-so, serial number, was killed on this date. That will go through the adjutant general channels to AEF G1. They send
The G1 is the
personnel section.
Okay.
And they will send consolidated confidential cables to the War Department in Washington. Pershing was adamant that these will be confidential because he didn't want to give any information to the enemy, particularly as you're talking units and losses and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The Adjutant General's office, as part of the War Department in D.C., would then dispatch telegrams, the Western Union telegrams. That's really the first ones that you see. Two families saying, you know, in stark language, so-and-so was killed this date.
So, and this is a form letter?
Pretty much, okay. Yeah. There's really no deviation from it, just slight wordage. But that's their first this has happened.
Okay, so we still have a body on a battlefield, presumably. What's happening to the soldier's body?
So in ideal world, every division appointed a burial officer. It was a lieutenant, somebody that just extra duty, got fired, and they were responsible for collecting a detail to take that soldier and inter them either at point of death or in a line. The divisions were instructed to try and collect them as best possible to preserve identifications and things like that. And if the division was static, they would. You would have the chaplain there kind of supervising this whole thing, performing burial rites. They would write the initial burial report, which said this soldier, this date, we buried him, this date, and this is where it is. Map grid, description, the whole, and this little card would then go through the division up to graves registration. Ideally, a dog tag would be accompanying that, and then one would be left on the soldier's body. Graves registration would collect those. Those would go back to Washington, but they would go to the chief graves registration service, which was Charles Pierce.
Right.
He would write that next letter to the family. First one was a form letter saying, oh, soldier's been buried. Or been killed, I can confirm they're buried this place, this location, this date. And in a lot of instances, the families would write him asking for more information. And he was, I think he was in his late 60s at the time, and he was very grandfatherly, fantastic walrus mustache. But a lot of them, families cite him specifically as really being this great face of the Army, because he, you know, did his duty, obviously, as a military officer, but excluded a lot of care as well.
So he's what you want in a chaplain.
100%. He was the right man for this job at the right time.
This is a massive amount of correspondence we're talking
about. Yes. His file at NARA 2 is pretty interesting. Pretty depressing, too. But, but yeah, he's really representing the Army. You know, you can kind of trace all this back to him in the early part of the war.
We've got, as you said, kind of battlefield burials or maybe division collection burials. How do we then go from that to maybe a national cemetery in France or bringing some of those back to the United States?
So, and this is where we talk about final interment, because now as the battle line moves forward or stabilizes, now the Graves Registration Service is coming through. And they'll, if it's a division cemetery, great. They'll dig them up. They'll confirm identities and that they're lined up with headstones, maybe rebury them. If they come across what they would call isolated burials, onesies and twosies, they try to consolidate those in concentration cemeteries, temporary cemeteries, because that's easier to manage. And you know, we can make sure identities are right to crosses. And this is going on 1918, 1919, after the war. The idea is that we will know what we're doing with these bodies by the end of 1919. The Army, have sent out what they call polls to all the families. And it said, hey, you know, war's over. Here are your choices. Well, why is there a choice? Goes back to August 1918. A flyer is shot down in France. His name happens to be Quentin Roosevelt. Pierce writes the same letter. After the war, his body will be returned. Great. Well, TR responds to the Army Chief of Staff and says, we believe where a tree falls, let it lie, meaning we want him buried where he fell. Other families had written this, but it hadn't mattered. But now that a former president has written it, it matters.
Right, and former kind of Army officer.
Yes, and this, obviously, it goes up to Peyton March, and I think he understood his predicament, and so he writes, because this has made the papers too, this letter. He writes that, you know, President Roosevelt's request is granted and the same will be afforded to all families that request so. Well, this is a big deal because this has opened up some floodgates. And France notices this too. And a little bit of foreshadowing, because they write that there's this great eulogy that the French General Bordeaux over the graves of the first three that are killed out of the first. He's like, we will hold them in our hearts forever. I mean, they are dead set that they are going to have all of the American dead, because it's not only a responsibility and perhaps an honor, but it also links. I think they understand that if American soldiers are here buried,
right,
America will always be here for us. But so now we have a poll. Do you want your soldier retained overseas in what we will call a permanent overseas cemetery? Do you want them returned to a private cemetery in the United States or one of our national cemeteries in the United States? A fourth option will be added later for ancestral homeland. So we have a lot of first-generation immigrants, and families are still in Greece and all these places.
Right.
And that will be afforded as well.
I assume this is on the Army's dime?
It all is on the Army's dime. The only thing that is not on the Army's dime is if the family chooses the local cemetery and wants their own headstone. That is on them, but the Army will provide, I think it was $100, it was up to $250, I think, for any related burial.
Right, because a lot of these people are probably still pretty poor.
Very much so. Very much so. And it's a great gesture when you think about it, owing to that fact that they might want their soldier home, but might not be able to afford it.
Right.
So, yeah, those little things you kind of trace through here that the Army does very well.
So let's talk about two other aspects. One of them, again, somewhat distasteful. This is a segregated army.
Yes.
So are the black dead soldiers treated any differently?
Yes and no. So it's interesting, again, great. We talk about the Graves Registration Service, but really the unsung heroes in this whole thing are the labor battalions, which are segregated black soldiers that are doing the very menial task for the Army. And one of those is creating the cemeteries. They are the ones digging the holes that all these soldiers are in. And I never found a smoking gun, but I often wondered this. The overseas cemeteries are desegregated. You go through one, we always talk there's no difference between officer and enlisted, but there's no difference between a black soldier and a white soldier. They're all buried the same, and they're very much intermixed. That is not the case when they come home, especially in the national cemeteries. There's documentation in Arlington where Arlington, are asking the Army which of these soldiers are colored at the time. And so you'll see annotations, colored, colored, colored. Because Arlington had segregated sections that the African-American soldiers were buried in.
And it is the South. It's in Virginia.
It is. And you see this at Antietam National Cemetery as well. You'll see all the Civil War burials, see some World War I burials. You go to the back, big gap, and there's three headstones. And those are World War I soldiers that were buried segregated. And so, some of that still rears its head. Arlington, once the Army desegregated, because this is an Army cemetery, they filled in, they basically had paths, couple headstones, wide paths that separated the cemeteries. They since filled those in with burials, but that core group is still buried together.
So the other group that is relevant here is enemy combatants, basically.
Yes.
So in World War I, that's going to be mostly Germans.
Yes.
What happens when those die behind American lines, or American lines move across them?
Yeah, there is, within the Graves Registration Orders, bury the enemy dead. They are last in your priority. And so, again, it's a mixed bag. Sometimes it's just done out of haste. But sometimes, and especially with flyers, it's done with a lot of reverence.
Right. If I remember correctly, didn't the Germans bury Roosevelt first?
They did. Yeah. They did. In early photos, they obviously bury him. They put pieces of his plane as kind of an ad hoc marker. They provide the initial reports that the Army uses to tell the Roosevelts about how it happened. Yeah, they were very gracious because they held President Roosevelt in high esteem.
Right.
Even absent that, flyers did receive a little bit different treatment, it seemed.
Kind of average German infantryman might.
Right.
What about the other direction? What about when Germans ended up with American dead?
We found cemeteries, obviously, outside prisons, their prison camps. And then even in the battle lines, not so much with the Americans, mostly in the prisons. But you would see instances where Germans buried French or British, and generally they were, you know, because it was kind of all that Judeo-Christian.
Right.
You know, they were.
And German is the largest ethnic group in America, so there's some connection there.
Yeah. But no, generally pretty good treatment. Certainly absent war crimes and things like that did occur. Mm-hmm. But, and that was something the GRS understood as part of its job was, as you're doing these burials, you're also looking for potential crimes mm-hmm. that occur.
So you've mentioned lots of precedents that have been set, basically from 1900 to 1920, give or take. I assume all of these stick around after World War One.
A lot of them do, yes. And it's running the gamut of, you know, what we talked about. The family will have choices in their burials. We will have flag-covered caskets. We saw a little bit in the Spanish-American War. That was, I don't say, fairly standard in World War One, even to the point where, but it's all figuring this out, and it's all just suggestions. Like, what do we do with this? Soldier came back, like, hey, we have this flag that's on top of the casket. What do I do with it once we put the soldier in the ground? Does it stay with it? What do I do with it? And someone's like, we should just give it to the family as a token of remembrance. Great. That's what we'll do. And that sticks around. So it's, in a lot of ways, you see that. But things we even experience today, families were writing, or funeral directors were writing, family wants to see the body. I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. And the army comes back, what do we do? Well, if it's in a private cemetery, they can do whatever they want. If it's in a national cemetery, we can say no, because it's been buried a couple times. It's been 3, 4, 5 years.
In World War One, it might have been hit by an artillery shell.
Very much. And, you know, there was no embalming or anything with most of these guys. It's probably not a good idea. But if it's private, it's their prerogative. If it's still under our control, we're going to say no.
Yeah.
And so in the late 20s, a lot of these things get codified in Army regulation, which hadn't been done previous. The GRS was just writing bulletins that kind of became their regulations, their operating regulations.
They're writing their own, or this is being written above?
They were writing their own, and then post-World War One, the Army regulations started.
And this is the AG writing it?
It would be the Quartermaster Corps.
Okay.
It's Quartermaster Corps.
So with that said, so in World War One, we had a Graves Registration Detachment that basically we almost created, almost in an ad hoc basis. We brought this chaplain on board.
Yeah.
They formed up a couple companies. Is this now, by 1920, into the 20s, a formal part of the logistics corps or the service corps?
Yes, the Quartermaster Corps absorbs the Graves. Well, they always had the Graves Registration Service, but absorbs it in terms of training and things of that nature and writing the regulations. And
so
all
there
that.
Are formal companies at the field army level that that is what they do?
Yes. Yes, and those will carry forward into World War II, and World War II starts. All right, what did we do last time? And that's going to become the impetus. But one of the big ones was, before we put cemeteries down, we need to ask the country's permissions, mm-hmm. not only to have the cemeteries, but to disinter, because this was a huge blow-up with France in 1919. We had done all this polling. We knew how many were going to come back, how many were going to be permanent, and France said no. Mm-hmm. You're not moving anybody in the zone of the armies, which was basically the battlefront, for a period of 5 years. It was amazing how flat-footed we were caught in that we're like, we can't believe this. But you look at all the speeches and everything that was said by French officials to the Americans. It was, we want to keep them. But so about 15 months, we're just stuck.
Yeah.
And there's a huge groundswell in America. And it was interesting because it was very bifurcated. They all need to stay. They all need to come home. The greatest, most obvious, you know, little, I don't know, lobbying committee, bring home the Soldier Dead League. Bring them all home.
Yeah.
But it was so interesting that, you know, some things never change, that one group was trying to speak for everybody. And then finally the army's like, we're going to let the mothers decide, or the fathers. Mm-hmm. And, but it takes a little bit of give and take politically to get France to acquiesce a little bit. And a lot of what France was holding, you know, trying to hold the United States up on was not just this political point, but a logistical point.
Right.
That we haven't even started with ours. We have 500,000 requests from families.
Right.
You know, 70,000 is a drop in the bucket.
Right.
And we have sanitary, you know, imagine we've just gone through this for France for 4 years, and now we want just, you know, lines of caskets going through towns. Like,
plus the Spanish flu.
Spanish flu has definitely been a consideration. And, you know, yeah, as we start to dig guys up that had this, are we just re-releasing this?
So physically, who's doing it? So physically, are we asking the French to do this in a contractor fashion? Is this American Army?
Both, yes. So the Graves Registration Service is back supervising the concentration. So we had, you know, thousands of temporary cemeteries, and we're going to get down to, you know, just a handful of permanent cemeteries. But they're supervising this effort. They've got French contractors. They still have the labor battalions that are doing the physical work of disinterment, creating the cemeteries. Certainly the Graves Registration's doing the you know, the architecture,
but the physical movement's going on railroad,
rail, going back, truck.
So when you're talking about the French, like, hey, we have our own problems.
Yeah,
it's yes, we're fully supportive, but my train tracks are being used.
Right, and especially in the zone of the armies where we've just had this thing called a war, not all of this is working right now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Americans were very much short-sighted in this. We want it done now. Not fully understanding what the French were going through. A lot of the newspapers see this as just French stonewalling us. They're trying to hold the bodies hostage. And,
right.
But there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
But and the Army does a great job, I think, of, all right, we'll meet you halfway. How about we start in October of 1920, around the time that the French are going to start. Mm-hmm. And we will only bring the bodies home that were specifically requested. So that's all the unidentified or all the unknowns and all the ones we can't, you know, the unclaimed bodies, as it were, mm-hmm. and then the families that want to stay there.
Right.
And so you'll have a significant number.
So let's talk about something you just mentioned, which is a tradition that comes out of World War I in many countries. I believe the French started, and that's the idea of a Tomb of the Unknowns.
The French are the first.
Yeah, and if people are not aware, under the Arc de Triomphe is the French Tomb of the Unknown Soldier.
Right.
It's kind of inconspicuous, oddly enough, but it's definitely there. So what is this tradition? What does it mean to militaries?
So the where it's born out of is, you know, bodies are coming home, bodies are being buried overseas, and they're under a marked grave. But for the unknown, those mothers, those families, they have no place to mourn. And it was interesting, Dr. Wise at UNT is like, you need to read American Way of Death as part of this, just to understand, you know, some of these things. And it was really, you know, what is the importance of seeing is believing?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, sometimes you don't believe that they're dead until you have that visceral proof.
Yeah.
It's like when somebody just goes missing, kidnapping.
Right.
Are they alive? Are they dead? Are they suffering? And so the idea of having, seeing a body, having a physical place to mourn, there's importance in that. Well, if your soldier's unidentified, you don't get that.
Right.
You can go up to a grave and you're like, is this him? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So this became a symbolic place for all those families to grieve.
Yeah.
And, but it, you know, it kind of morphs into that national grief for mm-hmm. you know, the collective sacrifice. So the French start it. They pick a soldier, and they have, I can't remember how many bodies they laid out for him to select. He selected the, I think it was the 13th, if I remember right, and it was just because of his unit was why he picked that. The British have an officer select theirs, and the Americans, like, ah, we don't want to do that. So they pick a decorated sergeant, Sergeant Younger. He's the one that will select our unknown.
And so, briefly, what's the U.S. Army tradition here? People might have been to Washington and seen the tomb and the soldiers marching, but what does this become today?
Oh, it's... It, it, I think it's morphed to something more than just the unknown soldier. The three unknowns that are there, the World War One soldiers under the sarcophagus, World War II and Korea are in front of it. There's three slabs. The third was for Vietnam unknown, who was later identified. So now it's just in memoriam to all missing servicemen. But it's really that it's almost a site of national acknowledgement to the sacrifices borne throughout our military history. I think some go there acknowledging that these are the unknown. I know vets more go there acknowledging their buddies that, especially the World War II guys, Korea, even Vietnam, that never came home.
Yeah, huge numbers of people in those.
Very much so. But as far as the average American, I don't know that that's what they think about when they're there. I think it's become something greater of just that general sacrifice.
Yeah, sacrifice. So let's talk at least briefly about what happens after World War One, kind of through the 20th century. So when we get into World War Two, you know, largest by number war America fought. What changes about this process and what's continued?
Sure. So World War One, I view it as this is where we've got to figure out this entire process, really build it from the ground up. World War II, now it's the same thing, but it's a global problem. And you have soldiers, I mean, literally at the ends of the earth that the Graves Registration Service has to find in jungles and, you know, in ice and under water, random islands. It's just in, you know, the industrialization of war, it becomes more complex in how you find them. This idea of group burials for aircraft crashes, tank crews, where everything is just mush. And we know that these guys are in there, but we don't know which ones they are. And so we bury them as a group. And those are interesting because group burials come home and they are buried in a national cemetery that is geographically center to all of the next of kin. And that's how that one's figured out.
And I
think that's reading the post-war files, the burial files for soldiers, just looking at the lengths that the GRS went to try and locate and identify soldiers.
This is a massive administrative hurdle.
Very much so.
Everything is hard copy.
Yes. The old punch system.
Yeah. So so when a soldier enlists, I'm assuming they fill out a piece of paper.
Yep.
And before they deploy, they're probably asked to revalidate it.
Yeah, the emergency addressee form.
Now, is this held at the national level, or is this held at like field army level, or how does when we talk about World War One soldiers killed? Let's talk through kind of the administrative process, kind of, and how has that changed, and how has that kind of stayed the same?
So both, I would say, is that emergency addressee data at the national level, they have a copy, but then also the units have a copy because you'll have the national, through the War Department, notification of death. All of the correspondence regarding burial and options, that is all done through the War Department and the Graves Registration Service at the national level. But you will have unit commanders, unit chaplains writing letters of sympathy or buddies writing letters to families as well. And so there's an administrative burden for the units just to, and their letters are, I mean, they are sometimes heart-wrenching, but they provide a measure of closure that those form letters absolutely don't.
So let's take that to the other piece too, which is once the notification's complete, in World War II, massive amounts of units across large amounts of ground.
Right.
As much as a unit would dearly love to take care of every one of their soldiers, they have business farther on down the road. So where are these graves registration units and where are they held and whose job it
does it
become?
So they are everywhere. And there's photographic evidence of individual graves registration personnel that jump into Normandy, that come by glider. They are already an individual basis starting this collection and preservation. And then, you know, subsequent waves at the division core level. Here come more to start really bringing this all together. The first, Normandy, the first cemetery is on the beach itself.
So you're saying there are individual soldiers basically with MOS, main military occupational specialty, of graves registration all the way down, down to like the regimental level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then
detached for this purpose, because especially for the parachute troops, we know that it might be a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but any, even beginning the process is better than waiting potentially 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks in June.
Yes.
So is the notification process similar? Is it still kind of the form letter telegram and then a more detailed telegram later, or has it changed?
So that goes all the way through, about midway through Vietnam. We were using the telegrams as the primary means of notification. It starts to switch in Vietnam, where we have what we know today is a uniformed officer and a chaplain delivering this news in person.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's visceral accounts. You know, this little girl was riding her bike in the front yard, and she saw the Western Union boy. She says, boy. The guy was like 9 years old. Goes up, hands the telegram, and he's bicycling away. And she says, you know, I heard my mother scream this blood-curdling scream that I've never heard before or since. But that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And especially for families where it's maybe the wife living by herself or, you know, a more elderly lady.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they just get a piece of paper and they leave. But, all right, now we have a notification officer, a chaplain there to comfort them until a family member comes to kind of be with them. And then a second officer comes, not the one who delivered the world-crushing news, but a different one that's going to be your casualty assistance officer and help you with all the administrivia, you know, burial and things like that.
In popular media, if you've seen the movie We Were Soldiers, it's an interesting little side story, but and one of the reasons is because Hal Moore's wife, I cannot think of her name, is one of the kind of the pushers behind this, because they are getting these Western Union telegrams and like, we can't keep doing this.
Well, there's also, I think, a practicality. If you have, 444,000 dead in World War II versus the 50-odd thousand in Vietnam, it is possible to send an officer and a chaplain for every Vietnam casualty spread over years. Whereas your war, Dr. Nance, there's so many dying so fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is really an interesting thought, and I've kicked it around in my own head, is we've... As we talk about World War I, waiting years, now you're waiting days.
Mm-hmm.
As we think about large-scale combat operations, you know, World War II, Korea, really being our most recent examples, Vietnam is a little bit different animal in my mind, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have the capacity, putting will aside,
mm-hmm.
are we going to have the capacity to dedicate cargo aircraft to bring home the dead within days? Are we going to have the manpower to do notifications and assistance and all these things? And I don't know the answer to that. I think I know the answer to it.
We just don't like it.
Well, I think that's what it is. But I think it's a very uncomfortable conversation the Army has to have with itself, because the last time a soldier was temporarily interned was really Korea.
Yeah.
And it, even midway through that war, as we went up, we were creating temporary cemeteries, then the line came down. I'm like, oh, that's not a good idea. So we started this idea of concurrent return, that you're dead, we will get you evacuated, in this case to Japan, and then sent home.
And we were actually going to do that with ice packs. And I mean, the whole approach of how that is done is a massive logistical burden to manage.
Right.
And having been there.
Well, let's bridge the gap between World War II and the present. You mentioned one big change, which is notification in person. One of the other things that happens is the wars America fights post-World War II are fought in places against people who have not largely populated the United States and thus may have cultures that are different. Or in the case of Korea, you have a government controlling the space that is not friendly to the United States. So just in terms of the finding graves and identifying people, how is that done now for a war like Korea or Vietnam, or even, you know, subsequent wars?
Sure. So we have a dedicated organization. It's the DPAA, whose acronym escapes me at this Defense POW MIA Accounting
Agency.
Yes. They are chartered to specifically look for the dead and missing for World War II, Korea, Vietnam. World War I, it's interesting. We're not looking at, even though it's the smallest amount of missing, we're not. That agency is not charged to look for them.
Yeah.
So they are, you know, using historical research, these old casualty files with these old descriptions, and trying to find those sites. They also work with those governments. They're the ones going into North Korea and liaising with the North Koreans to retrieve bodies or remains of bodies. And so, yeah, they are doing that job on behalf of the United States.
And the great advance they have is DNA.
Very much so. You know, a lot of these identifications, World War One, World War Two. Sometimes you read it, you're like, I think they got the right person, but they are using the physical evidence, bone structure, things like that. And that's, yeah, DNA is just a game changer. But what they found initially as the DNA came on board is trying to find the familial line that's correct.
Right.
And so
you need the DNA, like, ancestry type database.
And that's what they've been tapping into.
Yeah.
Because it comes from a person who doesn't realize that they have this connection.
Right.
That can be just, you know, help provide closure, because they've found, in the case of Korea, they have brought home soldiers and their widows were still alive. 70 years later, they got to, it's amazing what they've had to do. They've taken their lumps, don't get me wrong, and some of those were well-deserved, but they have done a huge service in a lot of respects.
So let's talk about the conflicts in which both of you were in the military, the Global War on Terror conflicts, largely Iraq and Afghanistan. These are not fixed front wars. In the case of Afghanistan, it's not even a front war. There's no real enemy army that you're fighting. So how is it different in a war like that? A war like the one you were in early in Iraq, retired Colonel Nance. How is it different in a war like that, where you have all the modern technology, you have all of the systems, you have much better medical care, so fewer people are dying on battlefields. So what has changed about that kind of war?
As a, for instance, like, oh, personal experiences here, guy gets killed. Most of the time, particularly in Iraq, we hold the ground. And so we're able to recover the body instantaneously. There are cases where that isn't the case, particularly in a helicopter, a downed helicopter, something like that. But interestingly enough, we go out and get the ground.
Everything stops.
We go to get that. We get those guys.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the remains are brought back. If they're commingled, they do try their best. But at that point, it all goes into and all the major operating bases, so think division level for the most part, you had basically a mortuary on site.
So this is replacing the temporary cemetery.
Very much so.
So the mortuary on site, it's got the fridge, it's got the freezers.
Which is the technological advance.
All that kind of stuff. And then, personal experience, guy gets shot in the head. And they, you know, we keep them there. They basically are arranging for an aircraft to come in. They flew them into...
Who is they?
The Air Force is going to... So, again, we call up division. Division arranged for an aircraft. Aircraft flies in. I believe it was a C-130. It was early morning.
Mm-hmm.
Aircraft flew in. And at that point, that was the only thing on that airplane. You know, we talk about scale of effort. And we loaded him up onto the airplane, very heavy, by the way, because it was all the ice.
Right.
And then at that point, the aircraft went down. I think they went down to probably the theater main lock, which is in Kuwait.
Right.
Loaded him up onto a larger aircraft, which was a C-17.
Still the only thing on it.
And or potentially more bodies.
Or other bodies.
Yeah. And then taken to Dover. And then at Dover, Delaware is where all military bodies come through.
It's where their autopsy happens. And
at that point, it's called a dignified transfer. They bring them off, and then that goes from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's same. Yeah. We had one sub-step. Yeah. guy was killed in the morning. That evening, we had, I'd say, almost a funeral of sorts, where, you know, he came in and, you know, we moved the body from this 15-passenger van to a waiting Black Hawk helicopter, again, only thing on there. And that helicopter was going to jump to Baghdad, where he'd be loaded on an aircraft and taken through. But again, I think point of death to burial was, I think, 8 or 9 days.
Yeah, which air travel helps immensely.
Very much so. Yeah. And it, but some things don't change. Mm-hmm. You know, we still had to do a physical identification. There was still the accountability of all their personal effects that would get sent back to the next of kin. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting in the morgue, or standing in the morgue, and I knew my soldier was dead. And I, just having done all this, it's like, she doesn't know right now that he's dead. Those kids don't know. And it was really a heartbreaking moment, because we've had all these technological advances. We've made a lot of things easier, better. That part can't and probably won't change.
Yeah,
is how do you ruin somebody's life, mm-hmm, with that news? And it's, and there were technological advances can be great or bad, because before she found out through the Army, she found out through Facebook.
Yeah.
And so you know, there's just a lot of, it's 3D chess right now, because the Army regulation says we have 24 hours to notify them. Whew, that is too long,
yeah,
given all the other technological advances.
And the problem, of course, being is that when in Iraq in particular, and probably in Afghanistan, similar thing, is you go into comms blackout, which is, but the hard part is getting that in enough time, because the Army can literally go on, because soldiers have the ability to hook into the internet. You can throw the switch and nobody's talking back home, which immediately tells the family, because it'll happen mid-phone call.
Yeah.
It immediately tells the families something happened.
Right.
And what was happening by, this was 2011, is we were consolidating on big bases. They weren't doing big base blackouts anymore. And so that just made it even more difficult to try. And you could very easily appeal to your company, because they knew, they understood. But outside of that, it was, there was just so much that you couldn't control at that point. And two, I mean, still the flag drape casket and all those things that started 100 years ago were in large measure still present. Mm-hmm. It was really, and two, even just, you could see on the soldier side, everybody's like, I don't know what to do. But the key takeaway is do something. The family will remember that you did something and you were compassionate. If you're standoffish, they will also remember that. Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is like a lot, what really becomes important, and this is why I really like this past hour, is the processes and systems that we built up over the past 100+ years help. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, it's like, well, what do I do? You open the book and it tells you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we form letters for, you know, letters of sympathy and condolence and all that. It's all there. You know, the Army will have a system for everything, even death. It becomes a very mechanical process. But that helps, because you open a grave, you look for the dog tag. If the dog tag's not there, start emptying pockets, start doing, you know, it tells you, how can you preserve this identification, mm-hmm, all the way through? Then what do you do with it? It leaves nothing to the imagination to get that soldier identified and ultimately brought home, wherever home may be.
Yeah, it's kind of rounding this out. I didn't grow up around Army posts. I'm one of the few people in the building that's probably true of. And I didn't realize that the size of the cemetery just on Fort Leavenworth, just the main cemetery. So this question for both of you. What do you think the value of that is, of having those white grave markers, and they all look the same, regardless of the religious symbol on them? What do you think the value of that is, both for the Army and for the community?
I think it's a good reminder. It can be a good reminder, because you can also become immune to it, mm-hmm, if you drive by it every day and those are just white stones that you know are dead people. But I think where we, the army, we historians can do better is, what do those stones mean? Because each stone has a story. Mm-hmm. And how do we kind of bring that person's legacy back alive? Mm-hmm. Because I think there it's you can really derive great value. But it is, it's a place we can come together as a community, or as a country, depending on the cemetery. And even if it's for a brief moment, pause and reflect and remember. For some, it's a dedicated site of mourning mm-hmm. and loss. So it means different things to different people. Best quote I ever heard was, a cemetery comforts the disturbed and disturbs the comforted. And I think that is a profound way to think about what their value is. But it's interesting for the World War I overseas cemeteries, you know, Normandy, most famously, everybody thinks of, you look across that and you can be floored by that, but you need to remember that's only 40% of the dead statistically of that given area. Mm-hmm. 60% have been, you know, almost, it's one of those things you think about now, it's like, I understand why we gave families the option, but maybe we needed to have them all together to, here was the scale of our commitment and our loss. Mm-hmm. Hard to know.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting, right? Because, teaching at West Point, you have the West Point Military Cemetery there. Yeah. And that's famous because it is one of the oldest military cemeteries that's there, just because of the age of the place. What I like about it is that you have the stories that are it's the historical stories, but it's also, it connects you through the period.
Yeah.
So you can walk in and you can find Winfield Scott's tomb. You can find Buford's tomb. Custer is ostensibly buried there. We're reasonably certain that the bones are his, but not 100%. But you also can come across my classmates that are buried there. And it connects through. And the other thing, too, is one of the things I really like about military cemeteries, they're very egalitarian. One of the only two places in the U.S. Army that is completely egalitarian. Mm-hmm. At the West Point Cemetery, you have generals buried next to lieutenants.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting feel to it. And it's not just West Point, although West Point's famous because it attracts more than its share of generals because of what it mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. But you also have second lieutenants there.
Yeah, even at Arlington, I can't remember if it's Bradley or there's another four-star, but there's a sergeant right next to him. It's just like, it's very, the democracy of death. I titled my dissertation because once you're dead, it's all the same. And I think in a lot of ways, pulling out the segregation of cemeteries in the United States, we did a really good job of, if you were a lieutenant, captain, private, everybody's sacrifice was equal because everybody was treated the same way in terms of, we were going to temporary inter you, preserve your identification, we were going to get you to a final point of interment. And I think that goes to, those stories behind them, because I was given like 4 minutes with a congressional delegation at the West Point Cemetery. So we went to one spot, said, here's the Army in peace and war, because you had George Washington Goethals, Panama Canal, you had Ed White, the second, the astronaut behind him, you had Westmoreland, and this is what your army is about. It's not just this fighting, but we do so many other things mm-hmm. for the nation. And I think that's, if you kind of think about that in the cemetery, because certainly there are some whose lives were cut short, but there's some who had a lifetime of mm-hmm. giving mm-hmm. in different ways.
Yeah, as Lincoln famously said, lay so great a sacrifice on the altar of freedom.
Absolutely.
All right, Colonel Hatzinger, it's been a fascinating talk.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.